The Holy Gospel according to Mark, the 10th chapter. As Jesus and his disciples and a large crowd were leaving Jericho, Bartimaeus, son of Timaeus, a blind beggar, was sitting by the roadside. When he heard that it was Jesus of Nazareth, he began to shout out and say, "Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me!" Many sternly ordered him to be quiet, but he cried out even more loudly, "Son of David, have mercy on me!" Jesus stood still and said, "Call him here." And they called the blind man, saying to him, "Take heart, get up, he is calling you." So throwing off his cloak, he sprang up and came to Jesus. Then Jesus said to him, "What do you want me to do for you?" The blind man said to him, "My teacher, let me see again." Jesus said to him, "Go, your faith has made you well." Immediately he regained his sight and followed him on the way. The Gospel of the Lord.
Praise you,
Christ. I invite you to be seated. Jesus and his disciples and a large crowd are leaving Jericho, and there is another crowd on the side of the road watching as he approaches and sitting in the dust, surrounded by feet and legs, is a man called Bartimaeus, son of Timaeus. Peter Lockhart says it could also be translated son of poverty. His view is blocked by the people in front of him, but it doesn't really matter because Bartimaeus is blind. We don't know his age. We don't know how old he is, but he's an adult. And we don't know the circumstance. We know he wasn't blind from birth because he says he wants to see again. So he's had some disease or injury that has taken his vision. But he has no prospects, and he is forced to sit by the side of the road and beg. So you can imagine him spreading his cloak over his lap and onto the street so that people could deposit maybe a few coins or perhaps some kernels of wheat or maybe even, if he's lucky, a small piece of bread. At night, the cloak is a blanket he rolls up in against the night chill. Listening to all the sounds around him, and you can imagine all the sounds of all the voices and the people and the feet trampling down the road. In the midst of that sound, he's trying to perceive what is going on, and he overhears a name, Jesus of Nazareth. And Bartimaeus, the son of poverty, begins shouting out. Now, I was going to really shout this, but they got that microphone so loud. "Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me." And he repeats it. He's louder and louder. "Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me." And he's so loud and so desperate to get Jesus' attention. How many times have you and I uttered that prayer? "Jesus, have mercy on me. Jesus, help me." But his is more of a prayer, it's a confession too. "Jesus, son of David," he says. It's the only time in the whole gospel according to Mark that anybody calls Jesus the son of David, which is a title. It's the descendant of King David, a royal lineage, God's agent, the Messiah. And people try to shush him. "Be quiet, stop, shh." Perhaps he's an annoyance. An embarrassment, calling attention to himself like that. And maybe they mean well. Maybe it's like when one shushes a noisy child worried that they're going to disturb the people around them. But their reprimand has the potential to limit the range of Jesus' grace. As people of faith, we face obstacles all the time. prayers are not often answered instantly. Most of the time, we pray them and we beg them, Jesus, have mercy, Jesus, help me, over and over again, and the obstacles persist. But faith also persists. Faith keeps seeking, trusting that God will provide. Some stories from Mark's gospel that we've heard this year, lest we forget them. There's the one where friends are carrying a paralytic man, their close friend, on a stretcher to see Jesus, convinced that Jesus can make their friend whole and well again and give him back his ability to stand and walk. But they get to the house where Jesus is inside, and there are so many crowds, and it's so congested that they can't get anywhere near this holy man. And so they climb up on the roof and rip some of the shingles off, or the whatever, thatch sticks and plaster, and lower this man down through a roof and into Jesus's midst right there in front of him. And Jesus winds up healing the man, who gets up and he takes his little stretcher and he rolls it up and he walks out. There's the story about a woman who hears about Jesus, and she realizes that as a woman, she's not going to be able to speak to this man. Even if she wanted to try to speak to him in public, she's not supposed to. But even more than that, again, there's a great crowd around him and she can't get close. And so here she is, a woman who's been bleeding for a long time, and she thinks to herself, if I could just touch the fringes of his cloak, I know the power would come out right and he would heal me. And so she forces her arm. Can you imagine her just thrusting her arm through this crowd until she can just kind of tickle the fringe on his cloak, and instantly she feels power come out through him and in through her fingertips and her arm, and it heals her of her ailment. There's the story of a Syrophoenician woman who comes and begs Jesus to help her daughter, but Jesus puts up an obstacle and says to her, let the children be filled first, for it's not proper to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs. But her persistence and her clever argument change his mind, and her daughter is made well. A desperate father tells Jesus that his son is possessed of a demon, and he says to Jesus, whenever it seizes him, it throws him to the ground, and he foams at the mouth and gnashes his teeth, and his body becomes rigid. And he says, I asked your disciples to cast out the spirit, but they could not. Obstacle. But he persisted, and Jesus told him that the demon was gone from his son. Faith refuses to be silent. Faith facing obstacles does not give up. L.R. Nost says, when the world tells you to lower your head and submit in silence to how things are and always will be, lift your voice instead and sing bravely of how things can and should and will be, because that song is why you are here. In a BBC interview, Malala Yousafzai says, for my brothers, it was easy to think about the future. They can be anything they want. But for me, it was hard. And for that reason, I wanted to be educated and empower myself with knowledge. Her father was the principal of a school attended by 1,000 boys and girls, including Malala. And she was an excellent student with big aspirations for life, for a future that was threatened when the first signs of Taliban influence emerged. Part of this sort of anti-Western culture backlash that possessed her part of the world after 9/11 and the U.S.-led invasion of Afghanistan. In 2008, a Taliban leader declared that all female education would cease within a month, and any school that didn't comply would suffer consequences. A journalist from the BBC approached her father, the school principal, and asked him if he had any students who might be willing to talk about their impressions of their life under the Taliban. And he suggested his daughter, Malala. And the result was a blog online called The Diary of a Pakistani Schoolgirl. She used her voice and wrote these little blog things on a regular basis, a diary of sorts, where she argued for the rights of girls to be educated, and the blog began to pick up a big following. She said, "I wanted to speak for my rights, and I also didn't want my future to be just sitting in a room and being imprisoned by four walls and just cooking and giving birth to children. I don't want to see my life in that way." The Taliban, though, wanted to shush her. They had read the blog, too. They were furious at her resistance. And so, to silence her public voice, on the 9th of October, 2012, she got out of school, and she and 20 other people, students and a few teachers, got into the back of a truck that had some benches sitting back there. That was basically served as the school bus. And they were in this truck, and they were going home from school, and there were gunmen, members of the Taliban, on the side of the road who came up and blocked this truck and put their guns in their faces and shouted, "Who is Malala?" And, of course, two of the little schoolgirl friends, not even realizing they'd done it, glanced at her, which gave away who she was, and they immediately opened fire, hitting Malala in the head and injuring the two girls beside her. She was 15. She was rushed to a hospital where she couldn't, they stopped as much bleeding as they could. They air evacuated her by helicopter, airlifted her to a second hospital, and then she was flown to a third hospital where she underwent surgery to repair the wound in her head and the damage to the brain, and it was right there at her speech center. On October 15th of that year, 2012, she arrived at the Queen Elizabeth Hospital in Birmingham. And she stayed there for 3 months, and they kept her in a medically induced coma so that her brain could begin to heal. Her last memory was of being on a school bus in Swat in Pakistan. But when the doctors brought her out of the coma, she was surrounded by strangers and learned that she was in a foreign country. She says, "I opened my eyes, and the first thing I saw was that I was in a hospital, and I could see nurses and doctors." And she says, "I thanked God. Oh, Allah, I thank you because you have given me a new life, and I am alive." July 12, 9 months after that shooting, she stood up at the United Nations headquarters in New York and addressed a specially convened youth conference, a youth assembly. It was her 16th birthday, and her speech was broadcast all around the world. At age 17, she became the 2014 Nobel Peace Prize laureate. She was the youngest person to receive that in Nobel Prize history. Today, Malala Yousafzai is a Pakistani female education activist and a film and television producer. When asked what she thinks the militants achieved that day, she smiles. "I think they may be regretting that they shot Malala," she says. Now her voice is heard in every corner of the world. Elaine Welteroth says, "There is power in speaking your dreams into existence. When the world tells you to shrink, expand. When the world tells you to shrink, expand." The people looking down on Bartimaeus, the son of poverty, tell him, "Hush." Instead, Bartimaeus cries out even more loudly, "Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me! Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me!" And Jesus hears him and stops and tells the people, "Call him here." And now those who sought to silence this beggar have to assist Jesus in ministry to him. And they called the blind man, saying to him, "Take heart, get up, he is calling you." Call, called, calling. Three times that word in two sentences. Jesus is calling Bartimaeus in the same way that he called Peter and Andrew and James and John and Matthew and all the rest, and the same way that he calls to us. And Bartimaeus throws off his cloak, jumps up, joy, excitement, anticipation of healing. He is expecting that his life is about to be completely changed. He's not worried about if his cloak gets stolen. And Jesus asks Bartimaeus, "What do you want me to do for you?" Jesus is open and listening and full of care and concern for us as individuals. And he's prepared to transform our lives through healing, to answer our prayers when we cry out. And Bartimaeus doesn't seek any special privileges, only Jesus' grace and mercy. And Jesus says to him, "Go, your faith has made you well." And immediately, Bartimaeus receives his sight, and he goes and follows Jesus on the way. The one who was sitting on the road is now on the road, but the one who was beside the road is now on the road, walking with Jesus. Bartimaeus is no longer a son of poverty. He is now a son of promise. The promise is this, that God is gracious and kind and has saved us, and the God who raised Jesus from the dead will bring all things to a good end for us. And now, because it's Reformation, I'll tell you a tiny little Reformation story. We call this lagniappe in Louisiana. It means a little something extra added for good measure. So Martin Luther gave his last and final sermon, probably the most important, on February the 15th of 1546. That was a long time ago. It was known as the Sermon on the Final Words of David. It focused on God's grace and how important it was for people to have faith in God. Only five people showed up. He stood there in this big church and looked out at basically empty pews and five little individuals out there. And he was very disheartened, and after he was done preaching, Martin Luther was mad as a hornet. He had big emotions. And he wrote to a friend about his frustrations that people weren't there to hear him preach, and he despaired over what he feared was a failed Reformation. He thought, wow, nobody's listening, nobody cares, I'm talking, it's for nothing. And shortly after that, he died. But since then, generation upon generation of people around the world have hung on Martin Luther's every word. We have examined his sermons and picked them apart and written so many dissertations on him it would make you dizzy. And we have studied not only his sermons, but his commentaries and his table chats and every other thing that he has ever written. And in all of it, we find hope and strength and the unmerited, unquenchable grace and love of God. So we sing bravely how things can and will and should be, because that song is why we are here. Were they to take our house, goods, honor, child, or spouse, though life be wrenched away, they cannot win the day. God's kingdom is ours forever. Amen.